Europe appears to be on the brink of a recession. Eurostat, the European Union Statistics Agency, has released a report that reveals the Eurozone's debt-ridden economy and that of the broader 27-nation EU shrank in the second quarter after results were flat the quarter before. The Egyptian president has presented awards to the two top military commanders he forced out just 2 days ago. Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi and Lieutenant General Sami Anan received Egypt's highest medal 2 days after President Mohamed Morsi ordered them to retire and instead serve as his advisors. Morsi's surprise decision Sunday followed a powerful power struggle, that is, between him and a powerful military that sought to strip him of significant powers days before he took office. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Sit for Less, featuring the Zodi Chair and the Very Task Chair by Hayworth, online at sitforless.com.
WILL programs are made possible with support from The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377, open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. I should say welcome back to the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Every day, people from Mexico risk their lives to enter the United States. Many of them have become lost in the desert, and many have died. A few Americans have taken steps to help these undocumented people, who would otherwise die of exposure, but that puts them into direct conflict with their fellow citizens and with the U.S. government. Our guest for this hour, Ananda Rose, traveled to the Southwest to try to talk with people on both sides of this issue, those people who were motivated by compassion and those who were motivated by interest in law. And in this hour, she'll talk with us about what it is she learned. And this is what you will find, some of what you will find in her book, which is titled Showdown in the Sonoran Desert. The subtitle is Religion, Law, and the Immigration Controversy. The book is published by the Oxford University Press. Ananda Rose is a published poet and journalist. She recently received a doctorate in religion and society from Harvard Divinity School, and she is joining us this morning by phone. And Ms. Rose, hello.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. I appreciate it. And do I have it right that essentially the book, Showdown in the Sonoran Desert, was your dissertation for your degree from Harvard?
Precisely. That is exactly it. I was getting my doctorate in religion and society and have been focusing on the intersection of faith and politics in the Americas, largely speaking, and was looking for a project that would highlight the ways in which religion is really working as a sort of force of cohesion, optimism, hope on the world stage within the American context. So, because, you know, of course, religion often gets a very negative press in terms of fundamentalist violence and these sorts of realities, which are true and tragic. But I was hoping to highlight ways in which interfaith groups were working for causes of peace and justice and to see how that was playing out. So, you know, I found this locus along the U.S.-Mexico border, this highly contested area where many migrants were dying, starting in the late 90s, and the response of which was these interfaith coalitions, you know, trying to provide aid in a sort of biblically inspired way. So that was my dissertation. That was the original project, if you're correct.
Yeah. And I just, I think that perhaps one of the things that I was, one of the reasons I was interested in talking with you or the possibility of talking with you is when we have, when I come across something like this, where it's a subject that has been much discussed, debated, where it's quite polarized, if I guess I feel I like the opportunity to try and look at it from some different point of view. That is to say, if we put this in some different kind of frame, can we learn anything? Can we at least have a different kind of conversation? And to me, I think putting it in this kind of frame and considering religious values, at least I that's something that I don't feel that I've heard before. So I really like the opportunity at least to try and have a maybe a different kind of conversation about this.
Exactly. And even to open up, it doesn't have to be necessarily even just religious, but these sort of moral values that we may all share. And part of the idea of the book, it began with these religious and interfaith groups who were asking these questions of, you know, how do we balance, you know, law but also show compassion to the strangers amongst us? You know, how do we act with justice and love at the same time? I spend a lot of time with these folks who are driven by sort of mostly a religious, sentiment. But I wanted to open that up to see a range of opinions and feelings about the crisis in Arizona, about migrant deaths, and about, you know, what was happening in Arizona in these highly trafficked corridors, which had become corridors of death as a result of the U.S. government's border enforcement policies. Which were definitely clamping down on the border, but creating these deaths and a lot of chaos, especially in the Tucson sector and throughout Arizona. So it was about how ordinary Arizonans were sort of coping and dealing with this problem. Now, what I really enjoyed about the book was it began with the religious and interfaith side, and with the sort of idea of, like, we must offer radical hospitality, sort of taking from the Old Testament, the New Testament, these stories of loving the stranger, and trying to apply them to this very current situation. But from there, I wanted to also understand other viewpoints and how other people were thinking about it. So it was very important to me to also talk extensively to law enforcement agents, and to see, you know, what they had to say about this issue and the role of law in securing the borders, as well as ranchers and civil militia groups, as you know from reading the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you could set the stage a little bit because here we are talking about a place that in both a literal way and a figurative way, or figurative and literal, this is the front line. For right. this issue, where we have a border here that people, it's porous. There have been attempts by the United States government and by people who live there to prevent undocumented people from coming, and it seems that what that has done is, in a sense, is they have tried to address the problem by getting at the places that would be easiest, but that doesn't stop people from trying to come. What that does is that it truly puts many people in risk of death because of the extreme conditions that they're having to travel through. And it apparently has been the case that perhaps a couple thousand people we know, and who knows how many more it might be, have died as a result of trying to get to the United States.
Right, right. The numbers are, you know, always contested because one can't know for sure, but you know, there are definitely events in the last decade alone, at least 2,000 migrants who have perished in the desert attempting to enter. But that doesn't account for the hundreds more that actually just go missing, whose bodies are never found. And these deaths have arisen in response to, you know, the border enforcement crackdown in the 90s, which worked to shut off highly trafficked corridors, particularly, for example, along the San Diego-Tijuana, you know, line, and bolster, you know, personnel and agents along the Rio Grande in Texas. And what this left us with was, you know, these very remote and dangerous swaths of desert in Arizona that many thought, you know, nobody would try to go through. It's 3, it's 5, it's, you know, 6 days walking. It's very dangerous. But people did, and this, so what people refer to this as is the funnel effect, and the funnel effect was bringing these folks through Arizona to these very dangerous areas of wilderness, and there's just very many tragic stories. If you go to Arizona and start talking to these groups, particularly folks from No More Deaths or Humane Borders or Samaritans, but even if you talk to Border Patrol agents, and even if you talk to some of the, you know, civil militia members who've come across, you know, dead migrants or sick migrants, you know, they all have very sad and tragic stories that they have experienced and witnessed firsthand. You know, children suffering, mothers suffering, old women and men suffering, being found dead, et cetera, or, you know, dying of the elements and dehydration. So it's been a humanitarian crisis. Now, the thing that has happened is that with the border enforcement policies, there has been a serious decline in the amount of migrants trying to come through. Now, those numbers have dropped significantly according to Border Patrol numbers that they put out every year. However, even though that those numbers have fallen, migrant deaths are pretty much at a relative pace, meaning that, you know, every year over the past decade, between 150 and 250 migrants have died during that fiscal year. And that continues to happen because the journey has become so dangerous. And a lot of the people that you are seeing now who are trying to make this journey are actually people who have families in the United States, many of whom are American citizens, and who are here undocumented, have been here for years undocumented, and they get deported. Either they're, you know, discovered through a raid or through a minor traffic accident, and they end up being deported to any number of countries, mostly Mexico, Central America, South America, and their family is still back here. So they are willing to take this very dangerous journey to be reunited with their families, and this is part of the humanitarian crisis.
Let me, again, just very quickly introduce the guest, Ananda Rose. She is a published poet and a journalist. She is the author of the book Showdown in the Sonoran Desert, Religion, Law, and the Immigration Controversy. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And it takes a look at one specific place in the United States, and that is the border between Arizona and Mexico, where there are many undocumented people expose themselves to great danger in the effort to cross the border and get into the United States. And basically, the book tries to look at the people who are dealing with this, both people who feel motivated by their faith to try to help, people who also feel motivated by feelings of the importance of justice and the law, and that is to say, well, these people are breaking the law, and that's that. And also it tries to give some attention to the people who work for the government, like the border control people, and what their experience of all of this is, and to try to take a look at some of the moral, ethical dimensions of this problem and how people think about it. Questions and comments certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, tell me about some of the people that you met. Some of these folks who make the argument that says their faith puts a kind of responsibility on them to try to help people in need, and where they are, these folks that we're talking about here are definitely people in need.
Right. You mean the interfaith folks who are
yeah.
working? Right. Yeah, so many interesting, wonderful people down there. They refer to themselves as people of faith and conscience. That's to make the way that they refer to themselves more broad, because not everyone, these people can be, you know, very liberal Christian, or they could be more conservative Christian, or they could, I've met people who actually aren't Christian themselves and don't necessarily ascribe to the Bible, but who are humanists or Buddhists. Or Jewish, but still, the majority of them that I met down there definitely turn to certain passages of scripture in the Bible, such as, you know, the Levitical call to love neighbor as self, or they will turn to the story of the Good Samaritan, they will talk about Jesus's call to love the least of these, whosoever, you know, they may be, regardless of race, citizenship, or social status. They also talk about the many biblical narratives involving migration, exile, homelessness, as well as they refer to the passages in Genesis that talk about how everyone is created equally in the image of God. So they sort of stand behind this egalitarian ethic of humanity. So they're always picking up on these themes of justice, mercy, and unconditional love that are woven throughout the scriptures in their work. And the interesting thing about this project for me, and one of the reasons I've loved it all along, is that this issue about immigration is one of these issues that brings together groups from such politically diverse and theologically diverse spectrums. So, for example, just yesterday, if you look in the news, a whole group of diverse evangelical leaders met in Washington to try to lobby for humane immigration reform. I think they call themselves the Evangelical Immigration Table, and they came together to promote, you know, these six principles that they could come together and agree over. And the interesting thing is, on one end of this group, you have someone like Jim Wallace, who's very associates with evangelical, you know, left. He's the CEO of Sojourners. And then you also have someone like Dr. Richard Land, who is president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, who advocates a more fundamentalist biblical position, much more on the right. But that all of these groups are able to come together in this hope that we can make a more humane, reform plan based on some biblical tenets. Now, they don't lay out any public policy plans per se, but they sort of try to give a moral compass based on shared scripture. So that's why it's an interesting project, because it unites such diverse groups.
So, and then on the other side, you also talk with people who are really concerned about this issue, seem to be concerned about it as an issue of public safety. They're concerned about protecting their own property and the property of others. They're concerned overall with rule of law, and they would seem to be arguing that no matter what, the bottom line is here, the people that we're talking about are breaking the law. They might further argue that there are if people want to enter the United States, there are ways to do that legally,
right.
And they might indeed say, that there should be some discussion about how that works and how it should be changed, but that doesn't change the fact that some of the folks that we're talking about here are breaking the law by coming across the border.
Right, and there are a lot of people who, take that stand. I met a lot of really wonderful Border Patrol agents in the Tucson sector, and they actually themselves were people of faith, of the Christian faith, and felt that they needed to behave with compassion and love. But they also were motivated by a very strong duty to protect, to protect and serve the country, and to help, the borders remain strong and sovereign and secure. And they also found passages in the Bible as well, such as Romans, 13, which many folks go to who want to emphasize the importance of law in such debates as immigration. So there were people that I met that were on the side of law, but also, understood that this is a very difficult and painful and almost irresolvable issue, And then that's part of the problem that we have now, is because people who are a little bit more extreme about anti-immigrant sentiment, they feel that, they can't, their first act of coming into this country was breaking the law. So why should we give them any sort of pass towards citizenship? It's a very black and white approach, which has created, these divisions and this sort of paralysis, I think, at the congressional level to enact any immigration reform, because it's gotten stuck into this black and white paradigm of, either we give amnesty or we deport everybody, and there's no sort of real discussion going on about a more gray space that kind of combines all of these viewpoints and tries to broker some sort of in-between path. And that's what I think these evangelical leaders yesterday were trying to push for, was more nuanced discussion about immigration that takes into account both the rule of law, but also the respect for the God-given dignity of every person. So it's a very tricky balance. And so far, Congress has been unable to really do much. In fact, the only legislation that's really happened in terms of immigration over the last decade has only been in terms of enforcement. So you get things like the Secure Fence Act. I think it was 2006, and that allowed for, I think, 700 extra miles of wall, mostly in Arizona, and other heightened measures, security measures down there. But things like the DREAM Act, they don't get pushed through, or the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act, I think that was 6 or 7 years ago, that didn't go through either. So the only thing that's really happening is enforcement measures.
Then I guess I'm thinking that one of the things that I think, particularly when you were talking about how there's your hope, many people's hope, that there needs to be some dialogue, some real conversation about how it is we deal with this, and that there must in fact be some kind of a gray space that would somehow allow for the fact that people do want to come to the United States, and that perhaps we need them and should welcome them, But what do we do about the fact that if they step across the line, the first thing that they've done is broken the law? So we have to say, no, go back. We're going to send you back, but we'll tell you how you can come back later legally. And this gets to be very complicated. And I'm thinking,
very complicated,
you know, for me here this far away, it's really easy for me to think about, well, there should be some gray space. I guess I think if there's any place where it's going to be really difficult for people to talk about gray space, it's going to be there in the place
exactly.
that you were. And you would, I would think that they would be very difficult for them to be, say, a meeting ground between the people who say, our faith places on us this responsibility to deal compassionately with the person in need. You know, it's we're going all the way back to the Samaritan. And
right.
on the other hand, people saying, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, there must be respect for the law, and we have every right to want to see it enforced and expect that it would be. And so there, where could you possibly find some gray space
right.
between those folks?
It's so hard, and that's why tensions have been so high in a place like Arizona. And you have these, you know, in the book I describe a lot of different you know, interfaith, you know, coalition members that I came across who had come in, you know, direct conflict with law enforcement agents. For example, I met Walt Staten, who had responded to the death of I think she was a 14-year-old girl. She was coming from Central America to try to reunite with her family in L.A., I think it was, and she did not make the journey. Unfortunately, she passed away in this wildlife refuge in the Tucson sector, and so he ended up putting out water in that refuge to try and help other migrants like this young lady who perished, but he was arrested by or detained, I should say, by law enforcement agents and accused of knowingly littering, and this led to a whole protracted court case. He was faced with possible prison time and fines and all of this, and so it was this protracted case in which these members of No More Deaths were putting out water to try to do some sort of act of compassion, a good Samaritan, and in the end, it just went sour. And in the end, I think Walt Staten ended up not having to pay much of a fine, maybe a small one, and I think he was banned from the wildlife refuge. And I think he had to do some community service, picking up trash, ironically. This is just a very small example of the way that, you know, you have these religious groups who are going out and trying to do something like put out water. Or in another case, there was a member of No More Deaths who picked up three sick migrants out in the desert and were driving them to Tucson to get help. And they were arrested by Border Patrol and said to be harboring and transporting, which is a crime. So there's all this, you know, conflict going on between these groups. And what has happened, I think, in Arizona, as you say, is tensions are so high there. Like in a place like Chicago or Boston, where I'm located, it feels remote. It feels more abstract. But when you're down there, it's so visceral and so real. You know, you can see the wall for yourself just crossing the land. You can see the black box. You see the arrests on the side of the road. You see the big buses deporting, you know, people from the courthouses. You can go to the mass trials where, you know, dozens of migrants who have been captured are tried in these very quick, fast-track trials. You can see it all to yourself down there, so it's very real, and you can see how tensions can become very high. And I think that is how such a controversial immigration bill like SB 1070 arose. It was sort of in response to this chaos and this inability to resolve the situation. So, of course, SB 1070, which has been heard by the Supreme Court, and should be, we should hear a ruling on that in the next few days, actually.
Mm. All right. We have some callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that.
Great.
Starting here with someone in Lovington. This is line number one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
Do any of these groups take any action before these people enter the desert? I mean, can't they help them in Mexico?
Right, actually they do. No More Deaths has, along with many of these other groups, they have gotten permission from the Mexican government to set up first aid camps right along the border in Mexico. So I believe they weren't allowed to do that in the States. But yes, there are many shelters, which I write about in the book. Some are operated by religious folks. Some are operated by, you know, just lay people, non-religious folks. So yes, they have been setting up first aid camps right in Mexico. And Mexico itself has its own units that that try to provide a similar service. And also these groups, their main mission, actually, most of them, is to provide humanitarian aid. So a lot of them actually drive out into the desert with food and water, you know, looking for migrants who are suffering, or they leave out tanks of water like Humane Borders does. So there's a lot of movement going on. But as one of the pastors I met said, you know, it's really just a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid response. It does something, you know, but it's not, it doesn't fix the problem.
Well, I guess that really wasn't what I meant, help them before they even try to cross, you know, so they stay in Mexico. That's what I was talking about.
You mean help them economically?
Yes.
Right. Well, that, and again, that gets to is sort of the larger issues of why are people migrating? Because if you look worldwide, this is not just a phenomenon with the U.S. and Mexico or the U.S. and Central America. This is around the world. I think the U.N. recently estimated that there are 215 million people in the world with migrant status. So I think that, you know, you have these long-term issues around how do we address, you know, the root causes of migration. Why are people migrating? What can we do for them in their home countries? What can we do economically speaking, socially speaking, politically speaking, to motivate people to stay at home, to feel, you know, safe and secure, and like they can bring up their families in their own countries? And these are just large, large, painful, difficult questions. I'm not sure if that's
right. Yeah, it's all difficult. We could solve it with me talking about it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, I think that some people would really argue, though, that here, if we have folks who want to come to the United States, they're economic migrants. They want to come to the United States to work because, you know, the reason that people have always come to the United States because they think that it'll be a better life for them. And some people would argue we have people who want to come. We have the need for labor. So that it seems like the crux of the question is, okay, how can we make this work so that they can come here and be here legally? And
right.
And it seems like there have been periodically, in fact, going all the way back to the Bush administration,
Yeah. There
was this talk about, well, what we really need to do here is create a kind of a guest worker status for people so that they can come and be here legally. And it just seems, I guess I don't really quite understand how it is we can't get that worked out.
Well, exactly. And the reason we can't get that worked out points to the fact of how complicated this issue is because, you know, people have been, you know, kicking around ideas about guest worker programs forever, as you say, for decades, really, and we've never really come across anything that works. The issue with the guest worker program is that, you know, I think a lot of the people who oppose it, for example, in Congress, but also just folks across the nation, are worried that the U.S. government will not do its part to enforce that, you know, if we give these temporary visas out to workers that we could use and that we need, but there's a fear that we don't have the system in place to verify that they are who they are, and that they go home when they say they're going to go home. There hasn't been a big push by government to make sure that these mechanisms are in place. So trying to set up a proper guest worker program, you know, is a very complicated issue, and there hasn't been the real will or push to do so.
And
although many people say this would be part of a solution.
And would they specifically, like the people that you met there in Arizona, particularly the people who would say, "Look, we have to have a strong border here, and that's important." Would they support a program like that?
I think you'd find just about everything down there. I think you'd find people who say, if the government, you know, has really good mechanisms to verify that these people who are coming to the country to work on these guest worker visas are good people, that they don't have criminal records in Mexico. Now, this would, of course, require Mexico and the United States or Mexico and Honduras or U.S. and any other country to have a very good cooperation in place so that they can make sure that all of these people who come in have had criminal background checks and that once they're here, that the U.S. is really set up to really look after them and make sure that they are going home when they say they're going home. I think people fear that isn't in place and that won't happen, and so they don't they don't want that to happen. And also there's sentiment, however grounded or not in reality, that that these guest workers may take U.S. jobs, that these are jobs that Americans should be doing. So you have folks on that side, too. You know, you have people all over the, you know, the spectrum of opinion, I think, on this matter.
We'll talk some more with our guest, Ananda Rose, there. She's author of the book Showdown in the Sonoran Desert, and we have a caller we'll get right to in just a moment. First, we need to take a short break. This is Focus.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Kevin Lucas is a nationally known percussionist and marimbist who got his start in drum and bugle corps and now fronts his own band called the Kevin Lucas Orchestra. They call their music World Adult Contemporary Rock, and they've garnered various awards, including a songwriting nod from Billboard in 2011. The Kevin Lucas Orchestra will play the Illinois State Fair in Springfield on Saturday, and Kevin and his five-octave marimba will join us live on the Tuesday edition of Live and Local. The show airs weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Ananda Rose. She is a published poet and a journalist. She is the author of the book Showdown in the Sonoran Desert, Religion, Law, and the Immigration Controversies, published by the Oxford University Press, based in part of time that she spent in Arizona, at this area of the border between Arizona and Mexico, talking with people trying to find out how they think about the problem of illegal immigration there. And both people who say that the people who come here and who are undocumented, who are risking their lives to come, need help, and other people who say, no, this is a matter of law. They're breaking the law, so we should make sure that the law is followed and keep them out. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, as far as the moral issue, the way I think about it is if you live by a highway and some school bus driver falls asleep at the wheel and the school bus crashes into your home, I don't think the first thing you're going to think of is, oh, they're trespassing. I think that whole moral, the whole thing about it's the law is really silly. But I wanted to ask you a quick question, and I'll hang up and listen to you over the air. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, is there a you were characterizing the religious groups in Arizona and the interfaith groups. I was curious if there were any that were particularly on the side of it's the law, you know.
Definitely, yeah.
And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, definitely. I met a lot of folks who definitely identified as Christian, were active members of their church, and they felt that they really went to passages, for example, you know, the one I mentioned earlier, which a lot of people go to, Romans 13, I think it's 1-7, and it really talks about how, you know, the law is a divine mandate, the law is a gift from God, and it is our duty as Christians to follow that law as it is divine, and to obey and be dutiful to the laws above all. So you will come across, you know, for example, one of the leaders of one of the civil militia groups that I spent some time with down there, a very nice man. You know, he was actually, I think, second or third generation Mexican-American himself. But he really felt that it was important that everyone come here legally. And that when I asked him about the Bible, he said, you know, of course, you know, we want to be good to our brothers and sisters, our fellow men and women. It's important to have compassion, like Jesus said, but it's also really important to follow the rule of law. This is also a biblical principle. And for me, law comes first. As a person of faith, law comes first. And part of being a good Christian and being a compassionate Christian is obeying my country's laws. So that is actually a common, you will find that, you know, that opinion there as well.
How do you personally think about this? And can you understand or sympathize at all, particularly with that point of view, that the law and the law and order point of view that says, well, the moral weight is on the side of the law?
Yeah, you know, biblically speaking, I would have to agree with a lot of the pastors and clergy laymen that I, you know, and lay women that I spoke with. You know, biblically speaking, I think there's much more precedent in the Bible, sort of talks about, you know, giving help and succor and to the stranger and helping the least of these. However, there are, of course, these two passages which stress the law. And this gets into the problem of how do we use the Bible? This book that was written over 2,000 years ago, not taking into account modern borders, you know, ideas of democracy, ideas of citizenship, 2,000 miles of border between two countries. So, you know, it gets into the problem of what we could call proof texting, which is taking a passage from the Bible out of context or away from the original author's intent. But that said, you know, personally, I really sympathize, honestly, with sort of all the viewpoints. I think when any of the viewpoints become too extreme, of course, I don't go along with them, you know. So when people can only see, you know, law, or they can only see, you know, if they say, oh, but open borders, we should just have open borders, you know, because it's God's kingdom and we, you know, there are no borders in God's kingdom. So if anybody who goes too far this way or that way, I hesitate to take seriously, although I am interested in their, I am always interested in their viewpoint and how they come across that. So I think I myself sort of live in that gray, nuanced space, especially after hearing so many sides of things.
Yeah. Are there people that you've met who make that argument that says it's all God's kingdom and there should not be any, as far as God is concerned, there are no borders?
Yeah, definitely. It's like, you know, some of the nuns that I met, women religious I met in Mexico, you know, when asked, you know, do you feel bad ever that you are sort of helping, you know, folks break the U.S. laws, you know, by helping them stay here in these shelters, and then no, we don't feel bad. And mostly they're very good reasons that they give, biblical, you know, injunctions of love and all that. But I did meet some of them who would say, you know, but there are no borders, you know, it's all God's kingdom. So you definitely come across that. And I also came across folks, you know, certain folks, from some of these interfaith coalitions, again, more extreme, who were said, you know, we don't need a wall, we don't need security, we just need open borders. So there is, you know, I hate to say that because it is one of those stereotypes, but I will say it's really in the minority. Those viewpoints are in the minority, but they do exist.
All right, let's talk.
Just like the viewpoint on the other extreme, which we need a triple wall all the way through, 2,000 miles across, which is just logistically impossible. If you go down to the border, and you go to some of the desert areas or some of the mountain areas or some of the floodplains, you realize there's no way to build, you know, truly build a triple wall along 2,000 miles of border. It's just not possible. So, you know, you'll get all sorts of extreme opinions.
All right. Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign County. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, a couple of things. It is, until the spate of state laws has come about, the federal law, it's a civil violation to be undocumented in this country. So the whole idea that there's this, you know, it just seems to me that the Irish who are undocumented in the Northeast are not handled the same way. I mean, we don't have the same problem of having this impoverished nation, this long border of the first and third world, if you will. But the idea that we should be doing more for the Mexicans there is belied by the whole NAFTA thing. And this is perhaps a step away from the moral dimension, but at the time of NAFTA, there were words about how it was going to help Mexican economy, but it included militarizing the border at that early stage. So they knew that this was going to cause pressure. You can't dump corn into a nation that's been relying that way and decimate the countryside without an effect. So it just seems to me that, you know, I don't know how far the calculations went, whether there also is this inconvenient truth, apparently, that lower income people in this country have actually had a rise in income in the last report. And some people, I don't know if it's tendentious, but they speculate that because of the exodus of Mexican labor, that there actually is a wage increase that's been seen. There's been a necessity of paying more, and I just what I was pointing at was that I wonder how I don't know how calculated this is, this mm-hmm. Race to the bottom kind of phenomena. But anyway, that's a lot, and it's a bit of a step away from.
No, I think that the moral dimension actually does is totally. NAFTA is a very important subject, and if you talk to folks down at the border, especially someone named Reverend John Fife, who is very active in the sanctuary movement of the 80s and is also one of the founders of No More Deaths down there. He's a Presbyterian minister. He will talk to you a lot about NAFTA. Now, his viewpoint, of course, is that NAFTA has been detrimental to folks in Mexico, whereas you'll find other people who say, no, NAFTA, you know, NAFTA's been a help. It's given Mexicans jobs. It's helped them develop their infrastructure down there. You know, and then there are other people who will bring up NAFTA and say, well, you know, it's a hypocrisy, a paradox, because with NAFTA, you know, on one end we had these open borders, you know, these wildly open borders in terms of trade, and at the same time we had these wildly closed borders in terms of labor and immigration. So the issue of NAFTA is extremely important in these dialogues and these questions, you know, economic questions, they're actually just right at the heart of everything. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, did you have much opportunity to talk with people, the migrants that we're talking about, to try to get at some understanding of what their situation was and particularly why it was they were taking the extreme risks mm-hmm. that they would have to take to try to come into the United States without documents?
Definitely. And it's interesting. It's actually, I think, as I mentioned earlier, it's changed over the last few years. And now if you go down there, I think the majority of people that you end up talking to in these shelters, it's a very sad stories. But, you know, I met people who, for example, had been deported through a raid. And this one man in particular, he wanted to try to just be reunited with his wife and his young daughter. And he had tried once and it didn't work, so they deported him again, and he was stuck in this border town. So he was talking, you know, maybe I'll go through Canada. Maybe Canada's the way through, you know, which I thought was interesting. You know, and then you'll meet all sorts of people these days who are just really trying to be reunited with their families. Now, you will also find people still who are coming through to, it can be anything from the dangers, you know, the violence of their towns. We can't forget, you know, the role that the drug cartels and the drug wars are playing in this. It's very, very sad. But unfortunately, this whole immigration issue is not completely detachable from issues of drug trade, the arms trade, sex trade. All of these things have become overlapping, which makes it even more confusing and more complex. So you still do have people who are, you know, either, you know, trying to flee a violent or, you know, situation or a situation of poverty. You do still find that. But I would say most recently, in the recent months, you'll find a lot of people who have been deported. Now, we must remember that during the Obama administration, and Obama has gotten a lot of flack from a lot of these groups, there's been a record number of deportations under his watch. I think it was almost 400,000 during last fiscal year. I think it's to beyond a million since he took office. So there's just a lot of deportations going on. And then you have a lot of people who have been, you know, they're no longer with their families, and they're just trying to get back in. So that's, at the moment, that's very, very common. But you will also find economic migrants and people who are just looking to find work, even though there's much less work here. The construction industry is down. It's harder to find, you know, lawn care jobs. All the jobs that people, you know, were coming for are not really quite so available.
Let me again introduce our guest for this hour, Ananda Rose. She is a published poet and journalist. She's the author of the book Showdown in the Sonoran Desert. The subtitle is Religion, Law, and the Immigration Controversy, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. And as we have explained, it's the basis of a lot of conversations that she had with people in Arizona, who on the border there between Arizona and Mexico, people who are truly on the front line of the immigration issue, because it has been a place, because of efforts to close the border other places, it's been a place where people have chosen to try to cross in the United States at great risk because it's very dangerous. And a lot of people have, in a relatively short period of time, people who have tried to do that have died. And this is about how people in the border region think about this, both people who are motivated often by their religious faith to try to help, and other people who are, in some cases, also motivated by religious faith, or at least argue very strongly that the law is important and following the law is important. And if people are breaking the law, then they should face the consequences for that. The book has all of those, an effort to try to include all of those perspectives. So if you're interested in this issue, you might want to look at it. Questions are welcome, too. We have, again, I say, about 5-6 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We also have the email if you're interested in sending something along that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe you could just talk a little bit more, because you did have the opportunity to talk with people who work for the Border Patrol, and I think that you did mention someone. I would imagine that for them, it may also be very difficult, because on the one hand, it is their job to enforce the border. But on the other, they know what these people are, what people go through. You know, they see people who may have endured great hardship and maybe were lucky to survive. How do they think about that?
Well, that's interesting. Of course, it's case by case. But I have to say that I was actually very surprised by sort of the grace and compassion of these Border Patrol agents, the ones that I came into contact with, both through ride-alongs, but also just out in the world. So I was very interested in taking photographs of the wall in different sections of the wall. So, you know, one day I was doing this. I was out in the middle of nowhere taking photos of the wall. And, of course, a Border Patrol agent drives up to make sure I'm not, you know, getting into any trouble. I'm not up to anything. And then, you know, I struck up a conversation with him. And then he started to just say, you know, look, to be honest, before I became a Border Patrol agent, I had some very extreme feelings about this issue. And he didn't elaborate. He just said very extreme, you know, feelings. And I think he was sort of speaking about sort of anti, you know, migration, anti-illegal immigration sentiments. But he said, you know, since I've been working in this job and I've had so many daily encounters with so many migrants and so many people who are just, they suffer so greatly, and most of them are just trying to come here, you know, to be with their family or to better their circumstances. He says it's really softened my stance, and I mostly just, you know, feel sad about it. But I still have to do my job, and I still have to perform my duty, and that duty is to, you know, secure the borders. And so, you know, you'll find a lot of folks like that. You know, the one man that I mentioned in the book, one of the agents that I drove around with for the day, he was Mexican-American himself. And that's another thing you'll see down there is, you know, a large number of the Border Patrol agents are Mexican-American. So they have, you know, sort of some of them have this conflicting feeling. So this particular agent who drove me around, he was actually born in Mexico and was brought to the States legally, he always made sure to say, when he was young, and then served in the U.S. military and then became a U.S. citizen. I grew up in a really poor border town in Texas. And he said, you know, it's so hard, you know, because he'll detain these people in the desert, you know, Mexicans, he speaks their language fluently. And some of them turn to me and say, don't you feel like a traitor? Don't you feel terrible doing this? And sometimes he says, yes, I feel terrible, but at the same time, I don't feel terrible because, you know, it has to be done. It's my duty. And also, he also really believed that by detaining people in these far out, outlandish areas of desert, that he was, in fact, helping people, you know, by not, they wouldn't get lost that way. He felt that every time that they detained 10 people, you know, that those 10 people weren't going to die in the desert. So I think they feel very conflicted, many of them, the ones I came across, at any rate.
I want to try to get one more caller here, at least someone in Urbana has just got us in. You got in here, so we'll do that. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I wonder if your lady, whether you have heard of the Ladrillo Project.
I haven't.
Beg your pardon?
I have not. The Ladrillo Project?
You could find it on the Internet. It was a project which was begun by the church that we attended in Douglas, Arizona, and my late husband was very instrumental in getting this started. A lady who came to our church from across the border was badly in need of some housing because she had to move out of her rental home, but she did own some property. And so the members of our church said, well, do you suppose we could get together and build a house for Maria, which they started doing. And they got other groups involved in building this home, like a congregation from as far away as Iowa, and some students from the University of Arizona came and helped, and various people, and that has just grown tremendously. It keeps people living across the border. They have, this was started, I think, in the late 80s, and they have built over 100 homes. You know, there's various churches have gotten involved and other businesses, et cetera. And it has, it is just amazing how that has grown, and that helps these people to be able to stay across the border because they are in destitute situations.
Right. Well, thank you. I will definitely look that up. I'm very interested.
Well, and I appreciate the story, and we're coming down to the point here where we're going to have to finish, so I can maybe give you about a minute to tell me if for you is there some, did you come to some conclusion here about how this, how we can grapple with this issue?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I try not to despair. I do believe that it's going to be a very messy road, that we need a lot of intense dialogue across factions. That there, it's just not going to be easy, that it's going to take time, but that it really needs to happen and needs to start happening as soon as possible, you know, so that we can fix these sort of this moral and political crisis that is occurring. But I think it's going to be difficult. I think dialogue is one of the only ways, and that's, you know, yeah, a slow process.
Well, again, if people are interested in reading something about what's happening truly on a front line of the immigration issue, this is a book that you can look for. The title is Showdown in the Sonoran Desert. It is published by the Oxford University Press by our guest, Ananda Rose. And Ms. Rose, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, whose 29th season features a 90th birthday celebration for composer George Walker, Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, hosts The Planets, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, conducted by Fred Stoltzfus, and Rush Hour in April. Ticket information is available at 333-6280.
On tomorrow's Focus, in the 10 o'clock hour of the program, a conversation with Dr. Jonathan Haidt, professor of ethical leadership at the Stern School of Business at New York University, author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, a conversation with Dr. Alan Teal, family physician who's also a specialist in geriatric medicine, author of the book Alone and Invisible No More, How Grassroots Community Action and 21st Century Technologies Can Empower Elders to Stay in Their Homes and Lead Healthier, Happier Lives. On Thursday's show, we'll hear from Bryce Hoffman, an award-winning journalist and author of American Icon, Alan Mulally, and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. That will be followed in the 11 o'clock hour by a conversation with Gerald Danzer, professor emeritus of history at the University of Illinois Chicago, author of Illinois, A History in Pictures. That's what's ahead on Focus in the next couple of days. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine here on WILL AM 580. Among the stories we're following at this hour, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is in Illinois today. He spoke to a group of business leaders in Chicago and told them that he's unhappy the presidential candidates have not spelled out their proposals on immigration policy. The Indianapolis City County Council has approved a proposal to provide health care benefits to the domestic partners of city workers. And Governor Quinn's office is touting a one-page analysis claiming higher education will suffer if lawmakers fail to address Illinois' pension problem. The analysis comes from the governor's own Office of Management and Budget. We'll tell you more about those and other stories within the next hour on the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look at what's happening in the commodity markets at this hour, starting with Kansas City wheat for September, trading at 855 and three quarters, down 12 and a quarter. December wheat at 880 and a quarter, down 12 and a half. Chicago wheat for September is at 847 and a half, down 9 and a quarter. December wheat at 865 and a quarter, down 10 and a half. September corn's at 784, up 1 and a quarter. December corn at 793, up 3 quarters. March 2013 corn at 796 and a half, up 3 quarters. May corn at 792 and a quarter, down a half. August soybeans trading at 1680, up 23 and 3 quarters. September beans at 1627, up 4 and 3 quarters. November beans at 1601 and a half, up 3 quarters. And January soybeans at 1596 and a quarter, up a half. August soybean meal trading at 527.80, up $1.50. August soybean oil at 5302.